marijuana ya.
Hah?
Eh? Smoke marijuana. Okay? Smoke marijuana.
Last September, I was standing at a street corner in the Cambodian capital, Phnom Penh. The reason I was here goes all the way back to the 1960s, to the Vietnam War and the conflict in Northern Ireland.
On my 35th birthday, driving into Belfast in my nice company car with my suit jacket hung up on the back, and I remember the point where I crossed the River Laggan, and I thought, I'm going to be doing the same journey 30 years from now, and instantly got depressed. And that was the start of a root-loosening process. Call it a midlife crisis, call it the hand of God, call it what you will. We went through a time of reflection and looking at what life could offer.
Before coming to Cambodia, Kirsten and I had never travelled to a developing country. We'd never travelled to Southeast Asia. So Cambodia was our first stop. And Cambodia is a country where, in our experience, people come and either love it or hate it. And when I landed in Phnom Penh, I lost my heart.
The Carson Audrey mentions is Carson Hart.
I'm Carson Hart. I'm a County Down man. Came out to Cambodia in 1993.
And Audrey is Carson's wife.
Thank you, Horn.
The conflict in Cambodia goes back to the 1960s and what was known then as the sideshow to the main event, the Vietnam War.
Above all, let's keep events in Southeast Asia in their proper perspective. The security and the progress of hundreds of millions of people everywhere depend importantly on us.
Cambodia has been used and abused as a country for decades. After the Vietnam War, the Khmer Rouge took control and killed almost 3 million of its own people.
What I find outrageous and immoral is the argument that this bombing somehow led to the genocide of 3 million people by their own government.
The Americans, the Soviets, the Chinese, the Vietnamese have all played their part in Cambodia having the distinction of being the most bombed and mine-infested place on earth. That's why Carson and Audrey came here, and it's why I'm here too.
We arrived in 1993, which was early days. We were still in emergency phase. In those days, we couldn't move outside of the city. It was too dangerous. They were still fighting outside in the countryside. The Khmer Rouge were still active, and we're restricted in our travel. If we did want to travel outside of the city, we had to go in convoy.
Came out to Cambodia in 1993, got involved with this organisation, training prosthetists, orthotists. A prosthetist is someone who makes prostheses, fits designs, puts them on, aligns them, and makes a person comfortable in them. A prosthesis is anything that replaces a part of the body that's missing. So an artificial leg is a prosthesis. I suppose officially dentures are prostheses, but we don't do dentures. They're another profession altogether. Orthotics are anything that supports a part of the body or modifies its shape or strengthens it. So prosthetics, replacement, orthotics, support. Very simple.
Back in Belfast in 93, things were not that different. It was still a year before the IRA ceasefire. During the 80s and 90s, Carson worked in Belfast dealing with victims of bombings and kneecappings, so he was well qualified to deal with Cambodia's landmine victims.
Yeah, guns in the street weren't a big issue for us. We laughed at our American friends and British friends who got themselves excited about gunfire and about the odd bang in the night. We were certainly used to the occasional bang in Belfast and certainly professionally at Musgrave Park Hospital. There was a noticeable part of my workload where it was injured people, from both sides of the conflict. And you would have had that very strange situation where occasionally you would have had people from opposite sides, shall we say, sharing a waiting room or even sharing a clinic room and sharing one thing in common. Both had given up a leg for their cause. And And always were wondering, was it worth it, to be honest. No, I certainly had plenty of experience of trauma treatment at Musgrave.
Okay, so can you do a radio check with location? Yep.
While Carson deals with the victims, I want to find out more about what's doing the damage. I've heard there were more than 1 million landmines laid in Cambodia. I'm at the headquarters of the demining charity Halo Trust.
So this is an HF radio, high-frequency radio.
My name is Grant Salisbury. I'm acting as Deputy Program Manager here in Cambodia for the Halo Trust. And we have about 1,100 staff, and I'm one of the managers that runs this operation. We do mine clearance and also disposal of exploded ordnance. In Cambodia, the problem of unexploded ordnance is widespread, we might even say generalized. Anywhere where there were troops fighting is an area that potentially people are going to find unexploded ordnance. That's compounded by the fact that the Americans bombed in huge quantities during the late 60s and early 70s. So there is a generalized problem from unexploded ordnance that cannot be realistically cleared. We can't send out teams and just clear all of Cambodia for the threat of unexploded ordnance, even though huge swathes of the countryside do have that threat. What we do instead is we respond through an explosive ordnance disposal call-out service to any items that local communities find.
Particularly in the era before mobile phones, having communications between all our teams remains essential. It's been aided by the development of mobile phones, but this is our primary means of communication, and it's even if all the cell networks in country go out, we can still communicate with all our teams, coordinate movements, and in the event of accidents, prepare a helicopter casualty evacuation and make all the arrangements with local hospitals to in anticipation of a victim's arrival.
The Halo Trust has a very good safety record with staff, but the reality of the dangers of 1 million landmines in the ground means that the majority of victims are children herding animals or playing in fields.
These are the nasty little weapons of war.
Absolutely. Most of the time what people are thinking about when they think of a landmine is a anti-personnel blast mine. That's a mine which you'll see here, which is generally ranges from the size of your fist to, maybe a bit larger than that. And it's usually a fairly simple mechanical. You may touch it. These have all had their explosive fill removed and rendered safe for display purposes. This one...
It's like a little plastic compact box for makeup or... A little tub that you'd get cream cheese in or something.
It's quite innocent
looking.
Exactly, it's about the size of a lady's jewelry box or something like that. What I'm holding here is a Chinese anti-personnel blast mine, which we call the Type 72 Alpha. It's a very common anti-personnel mine we find in Cambodia, and it was laid exclusively by the Khmer Rouge, which gives you an idea of who was supporting whom. The process is very simple. You have a pressure plate on top, so the weight of a human foot would compress this plate.
So the effect of that then is to send a blast upwards?
Yeah, so the...
It will literally blow your foot off.
Yeah, this mine is designed to take off your foot. Anti-personnel blast mines have a fairly steep blast cone, so which means that the blast wave is directed upwards and towards the foot that initiated the mine. Most landmines are designed to maim, but not to kill. The underlying notion being that it takes more of your enemy's resources to support a wounded soldier than it does to bury him.
Since 1970, there have been 60,000 civilian deaths from landmines in Cambodia. A further 44,000 civilians have been maimed, and this year there will be another 300 victims. So while the wars might have ended, the weapons continue to kill and wound. The initial purpose of Carson's work was fitting limbs.
The reason why the Cambodia Trust came to Cambodia in the first place was a direct response to a request to do something for the soldiers who had been injured and maimed during conflict. And the problem was just simply enormous, with a huge number of young people injured and killed as a result of unexploded ordnance and conflict. So the initial response of Cambodia Trust was to come and simply make legs. But that's not sustainable. An artificial limb is like a shoe. You can either grow out of it, it will wear out, or you know, it needs to be replaced. So simply providing people with limbs wasn't going to be sustainable. In 1993, Carson was offered the opportunity to set up the first school of prosthetics and orthotics in Cambodia. And it was that idea, it was that opportunity that really inspired us, because to simply come and make legs is a finite thing. You're not transferring any skills or adding any value as such. To come to a country and pass over the skill that you have to other people, to enable and empower them, is just entirely unique and a privilege. How could he refuse?
The issue is not entirely simple. I mean, it's not just a matter of bunging on a leg. Okay, that's where we started. We brought in a lot of people who knew how to make legs, and we bunged on a lot of legs. But the problem with working like that is that within 6 months of you departing, there's not a leg fit. Because if any of the listeners are involved in or know someone who's had an amputation, in the first year you need up to 3 legs, because as the soft tissue consolidates, as the swelling goes down, it starts to become a rattling fit, and then that has to be adjusted and eventually replaced. So having a visiting service where you pop in once a year and you gather up a lot of people and you make a lot of nice photographs doesn't work. It simply doesn't work. The setting up infrastructure, it became apparent very, very quickly to Cambodia Trust that having Cambodians do it permanently in the country was the way forward. Now, if you remember years ago, there was an old campaign that always ran at Christmas to stop people buying puppies at Christmas and abandoning them at New Year. A dog is not for Christmas, it's for life. Well, I mean, I don't want to be disrespectful in any shape or form, but as soon as a young person with an amputation walks through our doors, it's not a one-time event, fitting them with a leg. It's a lifetime commitment. The first year he's going to be in 3 times. The second year he's going to be in twice. And then, depending on his job, he's going to be in every year, every 2 years afterwards. And if we let this all fall over, or if we went home, or if we said, well, we've done a really good thing, bye-bye, within a year of us departing, nothing we've done would actually be working. So that's why we have to put Cambodians here, Cambodians doing it, Cambodians doing it for other Cambodians.
Thank you, Horn.
Audrey leaves me at the school that Carson has built up over the years.
Okay, we're here.
It's now located in a bright new building on the outskirts of Phnom Penh. The school and clinic wouldn't be out of place in any city in Ireland. I'm given a tour of the school by King Cicere, who will take over this year as the first Cambodian manager of the school at just 30 years of age.
So we are in the reception counter. The reception is actually a place where we greet our clients who come in through the door.
The first point of contact for clients is usually from Cambodia Trust outreach teams in villages across the country.
And for instance, if a person lost a limb through landmine, or the wig is very...
The next stage of the treatment is the assessment, where a cast is made of the damaged limb.
So we would use the plaster bandage to wrap around the limb and to take the, we call cast, a mold from the limb so that we can duplicate the mold. And
the cast is made into a mold from which the prosthetic limb will be made.
So for instance, after we have an impression from the casting room where we've been to, it's like...
It's a serious manufacturing process, using what's called appropriate technology. It's not high-tech, cutting-edge stuff, but it is affordable and sustainable. Nineteen years on, it's easy to forget that Carson left a good job behind in Belfast to take his family halfway around the world to a country ravaged by conflict.
The place was slightly crazy. It certainly was no place for a wife and child. But the potential was there. It was just at the end of the UN time. A lot of soldiers in the streets, a lot of gunfire, poor electricity and all the rest of it. And all credit to Audrey. She rolled up her sleeves and she said, we need to do this. And we felt very clear, a very clear call that this was what our lives were about. So we threw ourselves at it to such an extent that I have a tall Irish red-haired daughter who's more Cambodian than our Cambodian daughter.
Explain that to me.
Well, she was brought up here. It was her formative years. I suspect she'll be back here in some role or other at some point in the future. This feels like home to her. Our other daughter, who is Cambodian, we adopted in 1994. She's now 17, but her formative years were back in Ireland. So she's all dogs and ponies and welly boots and wax jackets and, probably spend her life driving a tatty van with a horse box behind it, you know. Cambodia had come out of, had been really a closed country, had been isolated by the West, firmly in the old communist bloc. Towards the end of the 80s, Paris Peace Accord was put in place, and all the money support that had been coming in for development through Vietnam, originating in Russia, tailed off. And as Russia fell over, in terms of the USSR, that the wall coming down thing, the impact here was that that source of external aid vamooshed. So the ongoing civil war between government and Khmer Rouge, which was mostly focused in the north and west, the peace was brokered, and eventually elections were held at the beginning of March 93, and a government was formed which then took over from the United Nations Transitional Authority. And Cambodia was the first country into which the UN came and ruled it for a period and then worked it through into a democratic change. So day to day, very few cars in the street. The city was about a third the size. Western goods weren't that easy to get. Electricity was in scarce supply. Drainage systems were poor. But the advantage of empty streets was I could always go home at lunchtime for a kip. It's not like that anymore. It's a very heaving, bustling metropolis. But, you know, every day, several times a day, you heard gunfire. The AK-47 was not just a weapon, it was a means of communication. If you thought there was bad boys in your street, you fired in the air. If it started to rain, you fired in the air. If there was a fire in your street, you called the fire brigade by firing in the air. If you needed the police to come, you fired in the air. And so gunfire was a day-to-day thing. I do remember one occasion we were watching television early on a Saturday evening, watching a video, and we heard a burst of automatic fire from outside our gate, and Audrey's response was, oh, it must be raining, I better go and bring the laundry in. But being so unusual, so different from Ireland, was the joy of it, and the joy of being able to figure out how to live a reasonable lifestyle with two gas rings and a small wooden house. I would definitely do it again. Would recommend it to anybody. Good to get get all the trapping knocked away and start from scratch again, see what's important.
Much of that civil war with the Khmer Rouge took place in the northwest of Cambodia. As a result, it remains one of the most densely mined places on earth. Today, I'm back with Grant at the minefields along the Thai border. We're searching for and destroying landmines. This work means less work in the long run for Carson.
Road's getting a bit muddy. Try not to drive into the rice paddy. Right now we're driving along the alignment of an old road that Irish teams have been clearing, and dotted along the sides of the road are dozens and dozens of yellow stakes, each of which marks the position of a landmine that was found and destroyed. These are mines laid by the Khmer Rouge. Chinese model called the Type 72 Alpha. They're small green mines, about comfortably fit in the palm of your hand, and they're designed to take off someone's foot. The real threat, however, is the thing which we can see passing on the right side, which is anti-tank mines that claim a disproportionate number of victims because they destroy entire vehicles and tend to kill the occupants of the vehicles. So the anti-personnel mines are certainly a threat, but it's really the anti-tank mines that are the reason that we're working here, because they would claim potentially dozens of victims at a time.
And have the people who are living here have they always known that there was landmines?
Yes, but this was the land that they were allocated by the government, and so this is where they've had to build their houses. There's a whole school and community center, a pagoda, all that have been built knowingly within a minefield.
It's only when you arrive at a village like this, surrounded by mines, that you realize how dangerous daily life can be here. Location manager Makra introduces me to one family.
A friend lost leg by mines, but he prepared all the area around his house, like in front there that okay. We are clear already, but behind his house is still minefield.
Okay.
He feel that he have friend and told the kid don't go there.
So it must be difficult to stop the children going into the fields.
Yes. I mean, yes. Difficult to stop the kid, the
okay.
Children. Yeah. She said she coming to living here since year 2000, and the Khmeru, he told her, don't go to that area, don't go to that area, because they know mines. Told her.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So there were Khmer Rouge living here.
Yeah.
And they said don't go here.
Yeah, don't go here. There. Told her to understand the area. Learned. And chang ka ro srul ro ai nung ro yang mai robiep to thoe ka thai rue
muay
okay is a I just ask her the easy to earn the money in this area, what they earn from, they said working in Thailand as a labor.
Oh, so they go from here
to Thailand quick. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
They say that.
Okay, and is she happy that the demining is happening?
He sees feel very happy. One thing, he can walk, can walk safely, and then do more agriculture.
Okay, thank you.
Go on.
Go on.
Later on, Makra tells me that 8 members of his own family were killed by the Khmer Rouge when he was a child, simply because his father was a teacher.
Sure. So right now we're walking down a very muddy strip of the road that formerly linked Malai District to Siem Reap, essentially. We are on a section of that old road which was abandoned because of the number of landmines laid. And we're walking past dozens of yellow stakes, each of which marks the location of a landmine that was found and destroyed by Halo's teams.
You're putting body armor on me now. There's a couple of famous photographs of people wearing this body armour.
Yes, you're thinking of the iconic image of Princess Diana wearing exactly what you have on you now. And she visited a minefield being cleared by Halo Trust in Angola. And the picture that was taken of her is probably the most famous image that people remember. And it's also the reason why they associate Princess Diana with the work that we do. Her son, Prince Harry, came to visit Halo and actually spent the night in a Halo D-minor camp and sort of repeated or walked in his mother's footsteps.
Okay, and now it's my turn.
Now it's your turn. Yes, exactly.
On our left, you can see the local population has already planted rice in the areas which we've cleared. We haven't obviously finished clearance of a site yet, but the pressure for land is so strong that even this bit has been reclaimed.
That's literally 5 or 6 meters from the edge here of the minefield.
Yeah, well, this area was in fact part of the minefield. You can see the yellow stakes within this rice paddy still marking the locations of mines that we found just days or weeks before they planted it. This starts to give you an idea that just how much demand there is for agricultural land in this country and the risk which people are willing to take in order to either increase the size of their fields or just to build their village or all these things. This is this H-Stamets detector, which combines ground-penetrating radar with metal detection technology. And you're going to hear the metal detector, which I will demonstrate for you now. And then you'll hear the beeping, which is the ground-penetrating radar indicating that it has found a positive response. So the operator is listening to both the metal detector and to those beeps, which are the GPR, the indication of the GPR in action. And together, he's going to make a determination of whether the signal is, in fact, just a simple scrap of metal or whether there is an object that needs to be investigated.
In front of me, there are about 24 people, all in full body armor, scraping, raking, using metal detectors and radar to search for these remnants of war buried just below the surface.
We are checking, the field of us are checking, we found a big signal in here. So, it's a tank mine. No.
Makara has located a viable anti-tank mine containing about 4 kilos of explosives.
But there's only one type of anti-tank mine laid in this country, and that's the TM-46, which is a Soviet model, very simple, basic anti-tank mine, metal body, easy to find. The complicating factor is that there are all these small anti-personnel mines laid right around it, which have very minimal amounts of metal content and are very difficult to find. So the charge has been set next to the mine, and we're now walking back to the firing point along the electrical cable, which will be used to initiate the dem. You would have heard the field officer shout to make sure that there were nobody in the surrounding area. He will also have been positioned sentries to create a cordon around this area to make sure that there is no one within 100 meters of the place where the blast will take place. He's going to go back to the firing point and do a final check to make sure that there is no one in this area. And then he will use a exploder, essentially a capacitor, which produces a high voltage charge to initiate the detonator. And that will in turn set off the main charge and blow up the mine.
How many of these explosions are going on every day on this site, for instance?
Well, the number of explosions, the number of demolitions that will be done per day is the same as the number of mines that are found each day. Here we have found over 1,000 mines so far, so that would have meant that this process has been done more than 1,000 times already.
One three.
In February 2012, a few hundred metres from the site of this demolition, a similar TM-46 anti-tank mine killed 8 people in a single explosion. Back in Phnom Penh, County Down native Carson Hart is preparing for his biggest day of the year, the graduation of the 2011 class in prosthetics and orthotics. What started out as a project to replace Cambodian limbs has grown into an international centre of excellence.
I did it at one point joke and say we were going to change its name to the Axis of Evil School of Prosthetics, because we have started attracting young people from right across the region, as far north as North Korea, as far west as Iraq and Afghanistan, as far south as Kiribati, Papua New Guinea, all over Solomon Islands, Indonesia, Malaysia, Thailand, Burma, Myanmar, Laos, everywhere. And the reason we do that is so that we can maintain this school as a sort of centre of the network of clinics around the country. Because if you leave a set of clinics running in isolation, the quality will eventually spiral down. And in any country where standards are maintained, whether it be medicine or dentistry or prosthetics and orthotics, there's always a sort of focal point in that country, and the school's a focal point. But you can't keep on throwing money into an education institute on its own for no apparent reason. So this school's pretty much now sustained on fee-paying students. We're able to attract every year on the intake between 9 and 10 people who arrive with money in their pocket, and the other 2 or 3 places are then allocated to Cambodians, and we go out and look for supporters to back those people, and it moves them up, keeps the whole pot boiling, keeps the whole thing turning over.
So very quickly, how do you feel right now at this?
It's always quite exciting. We've done this 16 times. The first one I could hardly speak for the lump in my throat. Still gets me a bit. it's nice to see, but especially this class, it's nearly like grandkids, you know, because the kids that I taught are now the teachers. So it's a generational shift, this one.
Please welcome Mr. Carson Hart, Executive Director of Cambodia Health, who gave us speech. Excellencies, ladies and gentlemen, graduates, friends, partner organizations, I'm very happy to be invited to speak at this wonderful celebration, a celebration of success, the graduation of yet another class of young professionals who have dedicated their lives to prosthetics and orthotics. I personally am very proud to be associated with this year.
Thank you very much.
At the end of the day, it's about the individuals and the impact it makes on them. Hope restored, maybe some ambition restored, doors opened. And when I see young people now coming in as interns, kids with disability, who before would have at best sat at home and maybe washed the floor, but would have been told for the rest of their lives that they're worthless, seeing that transformation and they're in a workspace and being treated like everybody else, doing all the stuff that ordinary young interns are doing, including making the coffee and running the errands, it really comes home just what a huge impact this has on the lives of individuals. On a national scale, I mean, if we counted up all the people that have gone through the various rehab centres that have been dealt with by students who graduated from our programme, a saving in terms of lost production to this country is inestimable. I don't know where to start counting it. And then what really thrills me is the fact that the landmine disaster here has turned into something more positive for the region. And what we've learned in Cambodia is able to be packaged and moved on to other countries. The integrated approach, putting it all in one place, packaging it properly, and I count myself very privileged to have been part of it.